It's Philosophy Talk.
The philosopher Robert Nozick famously said that we should never interfere with consenting acts between capitalist adults.
Can free markets ever do more harm than good?
Markets inevitably raise moral issues.
If everything has a price, why isn't it okay to sell votes to the highest bidder?
Some markets undermine the ability of people to participate in a democracy.
Why isn't it okay to sell bodily organs?
Buying and selling isn't just about individual transactions.
Are there things that should not be for sale?
Our guest is Deborah Satz from Stanford University.
I'm accepting that markets are useful mechanisms for the production and distribution of goods, but the question is, what are their limits?
The moral cost of free markets.
Recorded in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we're recording the program in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, the moral costs of free markets.
Free markets? Are we going to knock free markets, Ken? I mean, free markets are wonderful things. They're truly open and free and not monopolized by a few big players or overly regulated by intrusive governments. In that case, they're amazingly efficient ways of providing people with the things they want and need. They're the chief engines of economic progress. They're singularly conducive to human happiness, Ken.
Gosh, John, your enthusiasm for free markets surprises me.
You don't like free markets? Are you some kind of socialist?
I like markets. I like markets in their place. But, you know, I don't believe that every good is best distributed by the market. I don't.
You're kidding. Give me an example.
Well, take something as simple as the air we breathe. I doubt that even you, with your apparently boundless enthusiasm for free markets, would suggest that there should be a price on air?
Well, you're cheating, Ken. Nobody controls the air, so nobody can stop you from breathing just because you don't pay the price, so you can't have a market in air.
You know, but in fact, there are markets in air. Markets in clean air, where companies get to buy and sell pollution credits. And that points to a different problem with markets. You buy your gas-guzzling dream car. The oil company gets rich. The car company gets rich. And me? I get to breathe dirty air.
Okay, well, what you're talking about here is externalities. That's what economists call externalities. Externalities are costs that are generated by an economic transaction between two parties, but are actually paid by someone else or borne by someone else, somebody not a party to the original transaction.
Well, right. Now you're getting onto it. Markets can generate lots of different externalities, and many of them are really morally problematic. But, you know, that wasn't my original point.
Well, what was your original point? I've lost track of it.
Well, look. Even if there could be a market for air, nobody in their right mind would accept it. I mean, look, people have a basic and equal right to air, and things to which we have a basic and equal right, well, they just shouldn't be subject to the whims of the market. You know, some folks having more, some folks having less, some folks having none at all.
Yeah, yada, yada, yada. I mean, there are lots of things that rich people have more of than poor people. The poor live in less luxurious houses than the rich. We drive less expensive cars than the rich. We go to less fancy schools than the rich, although we actually teach at a very fancy school. We have less access to the political process. The rich eat better. They probably don't wear as lousy clothing as you and I do. If you're going to restrict markets wherever they generate inequality, you've really got your work cut out for you, my friend.
Well, I didn't say that wherever markets generate inequality, they're bad and ought to be regulated. I didn't say that. But, you know, John, markets are not divine. They pay attention only to the bottom line, not to considerations of justice and morality. That's our job, and that's why markets sometimes need to be regulated or even altogether prohibited.
All right, so now what principles are you going to use? Principles to distinguish morally intolerable markets from the morally tolerable ones?
Well, votes, for example, definitely should not be traded on the free market. And public schools definitely should not be driven by markets. Public schools should offer an education that's good enough for rich and poor alike, independently of ability to pay. How do you like that?
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, those aren't principles, those are examples.
I know, but you know, I have to admit it. I was trying to avoid answering your question. Because, frankly, I don't know what the right principles are. I'm not even sure that all the moral limits of markets have to do with inequality. I think markets in women's sexual labor are problematic, deeply problematic. They give me the heebie-jeebies. But I don't think it's just because of inequality. Well, not exactly, anyway. You
sound pretty lost on this topic. I don't know if we can afford it on the free market, but I think we need to call on somebody who's thought a little harder and deeper about this question than you have or even I have, Ken.
And that would be our guest, Stanford philosopher Deborah Satz. She's the author of a very fine book, Why Some Things Should Not Be For Sale, The Moral Limits of Markets. She'll join us in a little bit.
And we want to hear from our market-savvy and morally engaged audience here at The Marsh as well.
We'll be taking live comments and questions, but first, our roving philosophical reporter, Angela Kilduff, talks to someone with first-hand experience in a morally problematic market. She files this report.
Nearly 90,000 people in the U.S. are waiting for a kidney transplant. Until a few years ago, 70-year-old Linda Umbach was one of them.
When I hit my 60s, then my kidney function began to drop precipitously. So when I was 64, I believe it was, they told me that I was going to either have to go on dialysis or have a transplant, or both.
Umbach soon learned that the waitlist had grown significantly in recent years, but the number of transplants had not.
I applied to Stanford for a kidney transplant, and they told me the wait was 7 to 8 years.
For many, the wait is too long, and thousands of kidney patients die every year.
So I got quite discouraged, knowing the statistics were heavily against me for even getting a call and getting a transplant because there were so many other people waiting.
The United Network for Organ Sharing manages waitlists and ensures that organs are distributed based on medical urgency, not on income level. It's illegal to buy or sell an organ, but because the length of the waitlist is so dire, the idea of incentivizing donors is catching on. Linda Umbach thinks that makes sense.
There's a lot of compensation that goes on in the medical world. Why should we compensate someone for donating an egg, for instance? I'm not trying to rank importance of things, but you have a kidney patient who is really on his way to dying, and I think it's extremely important to compensate someone who helps that person too.
So can you create a market for selling kidneys? In 1988, Iran created a regulated market, and it cleared the country's waitlist in just over 10 years. The American Transplant Congress has debated whether to incentivize donations, and the National Kidney Foundation supports tax credits to cover live donors' expenses. Umbach is wary of how a market for body parts might be perceived.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't call it market. I would call it for organ donation compensation. A market implies you stand out there and you hold a kidney up in the air and say, does anybody want to buy this? And that would lead to a bidding process.
Still, Umbach thinks compensation makes sense.
For the living donor, for instance, it's obviously there is expenses to them, there is cost to their work, there's time, there's, you know, pain from the surgery. And for the deceased donor's family, they also have costs. They have funeral costs, burial costs. Their loved one has been in the hospital, sometimes for some time, and those costs are huge.
Umbach co-founded the Bay Area Association of Kidney Patients and continues to support and educate patients and their families. She spent 3 years on a wait list, and her transplant came through just in time for her 40th wedding anniversary.
This was our anniversary gift, was my new kidney.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Angela Kilduff.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
And we're joined now by Deborah Satz. She's a professor of philosophy at Stanford University. She's author of Why Some Things Should Not Be For Sale, The Moral Limits of Markets. Deborah, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Deborah, the people you find discussing the pros and cons of markets are usually economists or business people or those saps on CNBC that are always telling us how great they are. What do we as philosophers, as a breed, as a brand, as a type of person, with our own little intellectual take on the world, what in the world do we have to contribute to the discussion? Apparently quite a bit. This is Oxford University Press, and it's a beautiful book.
And it is for sale.
And it is for sale, that's right.
So, I mean, I think it's unfortunate that the debates about markets have been monopolized by the economists and that the philosophers haven't been as much a part, because markets inevitably raise moral issues. Buying and selling things isn't just about individual transactions. The philosopher Robert Nozick famously said that we should never interfere with consenting acts between capitalist adults, meaning it's not an issue, it's just that it involves the two people. But markets involve rules that are enforced. They have third-party effects, such as externalities, which you referred to. They inevitably have effects on issues about equality and our relations with each other, and these ethical aspects of markets need to be looked at.
I think you're totally right, and which raises a question. Why don't economists, are economists just like trained not to think about those things, just to think about pure efficiency? Is that part of the ideology of economics or something?
I think economics as a discipline has changed and is probably changing again, but modern economics is very abstract. And so it abstracts away from the actual features of the goods that are being exchanged. And when you write an equation on a board, if you're an economist, it doesn't matter whether the equation is about the buying and selling of body parts or the buying and selling of apples. You're just looking at the mathematical properties.
So, Deborah, your book is about the limits of markets. But just to have a solid background, let's spend a few minutes nailing down the benefits of markets. What do you see as the benefits of markets?
So markets have clear and obvious benefits, and I'll mention two that I think are really important. First of all, they, under the right circumstances, are very efficient. So because people will only exchange things when they have something to gain, markets will tend, given that people are rational, to push production in a way that efficiently satisfies the desires of the people who are buying and selling. They're also really good instruments for individual freedom, because I don't have to ask anybody's permission to buy and sell things, and I don't have to agree with you about the value of the thing that we're buying and selling. So you might value the Bible as a religious text, and I might value it for some other reason, as an intellectual text, but we can still buy and sell Bibles together. And that means for individuals who disagree about the meaning of goods, markets are excellent institutions.
So that suggests, given those really amazing things, right, being and make free transactions across disagreements of all kinds, and the efficiency, that suggests there's got to be a pretty hard barrier that you're going to have to cross in order to say, let's not leave this to the free autonomous exchange rationality of self-governing agents. You got a pretty high barrier, don't you think?
Well, so this, theoretically, markets have these features. I should say that in the real world, many markets are not efficient, because many markets, in fact, most markets, produce externalities. That is, they have effects that fall on parties who are not themselves involved in the exchange.
This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. We're discussing the moral cost of free markets with Deborah Satz from Stanford University.
Now, in our next segment, we're going to dig into the limits of markets, particularly the moral limits of markets. Are there things that simply should never be bought or sold? Almost everyone agrees that votes shouldn't be for sale. But what about sexual favors or kidneys? If you needed a kidney and someone wanted to sell you one, why shouldn't you be able to buy it? What principles, if any, determine when markets are morally acceptable and when they are not?
Probing the moral limits of the market, along with questions from our live audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the moral cost of free markets with Deborah Satz, author of Why Some Things Just Should Not Be For Sale, The Moral Limits of Market.
Are there some things that just should never be bought and sold? What about votes? What about sex? What about human organs? Where's the line between morally acceptable and morally problematic markets? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either end of the stage.
So, Deborah, we want to get at, eventually, we want to get at what principles determine when markets are morally okay and when they aren't. But I want to start by laying a little groundwork. Let's look at some particular cases. We can start with the issue raised by our roving reporter. How would you explain to someone who was in desperate need of a kidney, had the money to buy it, and a willing seller, why they shouldn't be able to do that?
Well, I'm not sure in the end we shouldn't be able to do that, but let me raise some of the concerns, I think, that a kidney market would throw up. So one of the concerns is that we want to prevent what are called desperate exchanges. So we worry that when people are truly desperate, they'll do things that are not in their long-term interests. Now, it's true in the United States, where people have access to health care, many people have access to health care and clean water, you can live with one kidney perfectly well. But that's not true in the developing world. And people have found that where people did sell kidneys, particularly in an area of India, in Chennai, known as the Kidney Belt, a lot of people who sold their kidneys, of course, this was a black market, had enormous deterioration in their health. They also didn't know how many kidneys they had. So you want to, at the very least, make sure that a kidney market would be a regulated market. And there are problems with, when we think of the kidney market as a global system, with thinking about how to regulate it.
So the people, you said you want to prevent people from sort of making desperate bargains or something like that. And you're thinking of the kidney donor as desperate. Well, it sounds like there's always...
Of course, the buyer and the seller are both desperate
right.
in a kidney
market. They're both desperate. And I suppose we regulate this market out of a sense of, I don't know, concern for equality because you don't want rich people being able to buy something, and some kind of paternalism, right? But look what a paternalistic concern for equality and lack of and protecting people from desperation has produced. It's an amazing shortage. And wouldn't a market like, isn't what markets are for, to adjust supply to demand?
So a couple of things on that. Markets don't always work to increase supply. And I think this is a very important point. People often think when you've got a shortage, particularly because of a ban or a regulation, if you would open it up to a market, you'll increase supply. But there are a number of places where people have found that actually introducing a market decreases supply. So let me just say something about that, because it's I think it's important. When people are altruistically motivated to do something, they're doing it because they think it's the right thing to do, and then you offer to pay, often those people will not do what they were going to do. So just to give you an example, in a study in Switzerland where they were talking about the siting of toxic waste plants, when people in a community were offered money to accept the waste plant, the support for the waste plant went down as to what they were willing to do when they thought of it as a duty of citizenship. Now, that may just mean the price isn't right. Raise the price and you'll get more.
but now let's think about what you actually told us about the kidney market, though. The present situation has led to a black market in India where truly desperate and apparently ignorant people sell their kidneys. Whereas there's a lot of potential donors in the United States that aren't donating their second kidney. Now, they might not be donating their second kidney because there is some increased risk, but people take all kinds of risks. People actually pay money to jump out of airplanes and do all kinds of risky things. So maybe if you could get $20,000 for donating your kidney, and maybe the option of, maybe they'll give you $30,000 if you donate it all to a charity, just so that those altruistic people aren't. Maybe we could actually increase the number of available kidneys, kill very few people, because as you say, you can get by with one kidney in the U.S., and cut down on the need for a black market. So what's wrong with that?
Okay, so a couple of things. There are a lot of different kinds of markets. Actually, one of the, you know, take-home lessons of, you know, thinking about the ethics of the market is to think not all markets are the same. So there are markets that are relatively unregulated, where the kidney goes to the high person who has the most money. There are markets where you have a market on one side, but you have one buyer, like the government buys all the organs and then redistributes them according to need. The different kinds of markets you have raise different kinds of ethical considerations. So if you're imagining a market which is called a monopsony, where there's one buyer and many sellers, where the government is buying it and redistributing according to need, and there's a lot of regulation and follow-up care, and then you can deal with a lot of the problems about that the market, of the moral problems the market raises, but not all of them. So let me just point out one other thing, which is when you say that something is within the scope of the market, you change the cost of other markets nearby. So this is what's sometimes called a pecuniary externality. So the technical term, right? You change the prices in one market, and that has effects on the prices in another market. So you allow child labor. Not only is there a market in child labor, but you've now changed the cost of adult labor, right? Because when children are put to work, what adults are able to do, wages go down. In the same way, when you allow body parts to be part of the market, right, you're now changing the cost of other goods in the nearby market. And you might want to ask, is that a good thing to do?
Good question. I'm going to invite our audience to join in on here. We're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the moral limits of markets with Deborah Satz from Stanford University. And we'd love to have questions from this live audience and join you into this conversation. But I want to ask your point about that. So, yeah, okay, child labor is another kind of example that we in the West think is bad, and we've got all these laws outlawed, and you gave a kind of justification, but there's another kind of a justification. It seems to me it's just wrong to make children work. Children are not the kind of beings up to a certain age that should be exploited by the market. Aren't there some things, you kind of talked about pragmatic, aren't there some things that it's just intrinsically wrong to sell, not because of desperate bargains, it's just like the wrong kind of thing, the Kantian in me say, some things are above price or beyond price. Do you not think that's so or not?
I think that there are some things that we should not, it would be a moral mistake to treat as a market good.
As a mere commodity.
As a mere market good, like human beings. But there are a lot of things we can treat as a market good, but still respect in other ways. So, for example, it may be that you could have a market in kidneys, but it doesn't diminish the respect you have for people. Somebody who thinks that we ought to take attend to the people who are dying for lack of a kidney are going to argue that treating the kidney like a market good actually respects human dignity.
Right. Well, and that's why. And the reason I thought that is because if you think about sort of the things that it's intrinsically wrong to sell because of the kind of thing they are and the kind of relation they have to our agency and all that, you might get a small set of things that you wouldn't take to the market, but you might not get a large set of things that you wouldn't take to the market.
I don't think you'll get a very large set of things. Right. And I think child labor is actually an interesting case to think about because, of course, we in the West think that child labor is impermissible. But child labor for most of human history was permissible. And the problem with simply enacting, even if you think it's impermissible because of the kind of things that children are, if you ban child labor, you're likely in some context to produce worse outcomes for children. So if the alternatives are set a child to work or the child dies and their family dies of starvation, it's hard to justify right. the banning.
I mean, when I was a child, or at least, you know, 10 or 12, I got up at 3 in the morning to deliver papers. Nobody seemed to think that was immoral. So it's really not just an absolute ban on child labor, but let me ask about a more difficult case. I mean, kidneys in a way are easy because we've got two of them, but how about livers? I mean, if there was a market in livers, there's a certain number of people who probably maybe are looking forward to early demise, or they're very depressed and suicidal and think that, well, before I go, I might as well sell my liver and make a nice donation to all the people I've failed in my life. Why should that be illegal?
Right. So I think those are great questions to ask. It pushes us back either to think about what Ken was calling the Kantian view, which is there's something about the human person and their dignity that bans markets, or the line I was taking, which is to think about third-party effects. All markets transactions virtually have effects on third parties. That is, people are not part of the transaction, either by changing prices of nearby goods or by spillover effects. And we want to think about what are the spillover effects. Child labor has clear spillover effects, as I said, because it changes the costs of adult labor. And that means parents who don't want to have their children work, who live in a society where there's child labor, are going to have a lot harder time doing so. And then we want to ask, should people have to pay a price for not wanting to put their kids
to work? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the moral limits of markets with Deborah Satz from Stanford University. We'd love to have questions from our live audience. Go to either side of the stage and we'll get you into the program. And we've got a questioner here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man. Tell us your name, your question, where you're from.
Hi, my name is Corey. I live in Mountain View, and I have two questions. You can answer one or both. One is kind of the moral and ethical considerations where markets are involved with things that are known to be bad for you, like cigarettes and junk food. And I've noticed more state governments getting involved in looking at hydrogenated oils and fast food and that kind of thing. My second question is sort of related, is about if any of you have given any thought to what will happen to the marijuana market if that becomes legalized.
Two good questions, everyone. Take whichever one.
Seldom think about anything else.
Take whichever one you want in whatever order you want.
So one question is to ask, when do markets elicit our concern? What's different about an Apple market and a cigarette market? And I think we can think about a bunch of things that distinguish those markets. So one is, in a cigarette market, we might worry about the weak agency of the people involved in the market. So in some cases, cigarette companies target youth who don't fully know the consequences of smoking until quite, you know, recently. There's a whole history of the cigarette industry sort of hiding the effects and denying the effects of cigarette smoke. So we can worry about how much information people really have about the markets. We can worry about the harmful effects. Eating apples in general doesn't tend to produce really bad effects, but smoking cigarettes can. So that's a first party effect. Paternalism would be one reason to intervene in first party effects. People are rightly uncomfortable with the government, the nanny state, telling you what you can and can't do. And so in the cigarette case, of course, the thing that's actually gotten the attention of the public is the third-party effects, namely that cigarette smoke circulates.
Nobody objects to the cigarette companies have to have truth in advertising, as it were. Nobody objects to saying, look, you know that this is a cancer. You have to tell people, right? So that, at least enforcing a kind of informational honesty among producers and consumers. Is that?
Well, there's a lot of deception in the consumer markets.
Yeah, I know. Well, those are imperfect. But if you would think a moral constraint on a fairly operating market is that it not be filled with deception.
Yes, but there's something else about the case of cigarette smoking and the case of what I'm going to call weak agency, which is some markets have effects that are only known in the future. And there you might worry, and this goes partly to the kidney market, that somebody who's never given up a kidney, somebody who's youthful, doesn't know what the long-term consequences are going to be of engaging in that kind of activity and would come to regret it.
So weak agency, then, that's your term. That means not that the agent is a wuss, but that the agent is somehow doesn't have the knowledge they need to be a completely rational agent. Is that the idea?
Yes. It's more than that, but yes.
Okay, but we've got another question on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talks.
A quick one. Parviz from Berkeley. I'm asking this question for a photojournalist that's here from Iran. She says, are you claiming that the end of history is not here yet and capitalism and free market have not proven to be the only alternatives?
Thank you for the question. What about the,
That's a big question. So I'm not really thinking here about the market system as a whole versus other systems. So the debates between, you know, socialism and capitalism. I'm accepting that markets are useful mechanisms for the production and distribution of goods. And then the question is simply, what are their limits? So I'm considering my audience to be people who think markets have a place in our world, but the question is, what is the place? And even people who like markets get upset about certain kinds of markets. And so the question is to try to understand why.
In my opinion, the end of history is not yet here.
We've got another question in this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am. What's your name, question, where are you from?
I'm Margot from Los Altos, and I'm wondering, everybody seems to have said that votes should not be for sale, and I'm wondering, Deborah, about the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court and whether elections aren't going to be now for sale.
Okay, so some of you may know, a recent Supreme Court decision has argued that corporations can spend money as if they were individuals. We allow individuals to spend their own money on campaigns. This goes back to a case called Buckley versus Vallejo because they're seen as an extension of free speech. And I think there is an interesting question about the role of money in politics. And in particular, if you're concerned about democracy and you think democracy gives us a reason to care about the scope of the market, then a system that allows political influence to be distributed by ability to pay is going to be very problematic, because that's problematic from the point of view of what democracy is.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're examining the ethical cost of free markets with Deborah Satz, author of Why Some Things Should Not Be For Sale, The Moral Limits of Markets.
In our final segment, we'll ask about balancing the costs and benefits of markets. What about black markets? It seems that any time the sale of certain goods is prohibited, a black market pops up. If black markets are bound to arise, does that make things better or worse for those involved?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the moral cost of free markets with Deborah Satz, our colleague from Stanford University. And we've got a question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I'm Jeff from San Francisco. And in this country, at least, water is subsidized. And if you are going hungry, there are food stamps. There are other government programs for things like that. So reaching for the principle that you were talking about earlier of where the moral limits end, can we say that for things that are absolutely necessities to life, where without them you would in fact die, those should be accepted from the pure market forces?
Yes, from the pure market forces. But of course, we do use markets to distribute good to food. So although there are limits, to the use, it's not like, so think about votes as a case where you would say, even if you could be efficient in distributing votes through a market, and even if you know, the power of money wasn't an issue because everybody had the same amount of money and just disagreed about how much they cared about the vote. We still wouldn't want to distribute votes through a market. Food, we don't want to rely solely on a market because, as you say, it's a necessity of life, absolutely. But there's nothing intrinsically wrong with using a market to distribute food, but supplementing it with some other form of entitlement.
Now, Thales, one of the early philosophers,
apparently,
yes, he thought everything he thought everything was made of water. But I think he was also the guy that made a fortune by getting a corner on the fig presses one year when the figs were he could see the figs were going to be very plentiful. So, is that cornering markets in food and things that are related to food? Is that different morally than cornering the market on silver or gold or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the difference between somebody who owns all the water in a desert and somebody who owns all the yachts in, you know, America is a profound difference. It really matters that food is an urgent need. And so that somebody who owns something like that can command, has enormous power over people. Somebody owns the only all the yachts in America doesn't have enormous power over
people.
We've got
another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
I'm Alexi from Berkeley. I was wondering whether you thought pornographic markets should be controlled in some way, because it seems that pornography is a kind of prostitution in which people are paid to have sex.
There's a softball question for you.
This is a good audience.
So, pornography is a little bit like some of the other examples people have given where there are first-party issues mm-hmm. about how to think about what happens to people who consume pornography and whether there's reasons to be concerned about that. But there's also third-party issues. So the third-party issues are really about the way pornography affects the way women are viewed in society as a whole, what that means in terms of women's standing and opportunities. So you can't just view it as a private transaction. You've got to think about its third-party effects. Well, I think the third-party effects give us some reason, at least, it doesn't tell us what to do, but it says, if we care about women's equality, here's a dimension that we have to look at.
I understand that line, but I have a hard time with that line. So some person wants to be an actor and a porn star, maybe for desperate bargain reasons. I can understand that. And some pervert wants to consume that in the privacy of his home. With the third party effects. What are the third party? I know that line is there. It's because creepy people want to watch dirty pictures, thereby women are degraded. Well, not if I don't want. I mean, how does society? How does
You've already got regulation in the example you're giving because you're talking about consuming in your own home. But if you think about pornography as a market, the first thing is you might think of it as just, you know, anything that people, if I want to buy space on a billboard and put a naked person up, I should be able to do that. If I want to, paint buildings with pictures of people, I should be able to do that. So once you already say no, you know, private consumption is important, but we ought to regulate its public visibility, then we're already admitting it's a different kind of market.
So this leads to a question like this. I mean, there have been a lot of attempts to restrict markets. Prostitution, prohibition, the criminalization of drugs, and organ donation. Often do-gooders with power try to restrict what they regard as morally problematic markets, like the prohibitionists in alcohol. But in that case, and in some others, it seems to do more harm than good. Isn't in general morally preferable to let markets operate in the open, warts and all, than to force them underground?
So that's a very important question. I don't think you can get from the premise that a market is problematic to the conclusion that we ought to ban it. I think that sometimes banning a market makes things worse along the very dimensions that we care about. If we care about weak agency, or we care about inequality, or we care about desperation, banning the market just leads to more of those things.
For example,
but not always.
I know, but for example, just for example, then you can get to the not always. But for example, I take it banning markets and prostitution doesn't eliminate prostitution, but it eliminates the responsibility of the state to protect prostitutes from pimps and all this and disease and all that stuff. So it makes prostitutes worse off.
Or drug, you know, people have argued this about drug markets, that banning markets in drugs just drives them underground with much worse consequences
crime
for the people
and,
who
yeah.
participate in those. But sometimes we ban markets and we're very effective. And by banning the market, we actually produce outcomes that are preferable. So again, take child labor. Banning child labor in various societies leads to higher adult wages, which then leads to people not having to put their children to work. And you don't find in America, for example, an enormous black market in children's labor.
We've got another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Yeah, Jeremy Lane, Bernal Heights. I'm not entirely sure where this observation fits with the discussion, but what I see has happened over the last 20-odd years is that the market talk has become ubiquitous, and that we're no longer thought of as citizens, we're referred to as consumers repeatedly. And I see an electorate that seems to be confusing consumer choice with democracy. So these are some of the other external effects of markets, but they are spreading societal right across society.
Absolutely. So, and actually one of the things I think is very important in terms of the kind of framework I defend in my work is to think about the effects of markets on democratic societies. So that some markets undermine the ability of people to participate in a democracy. So the Citizens United, the power of money now in elections starts to treat the political process itself, right, as a market good. And we all lose from that, because if you have the idea that really what elections are about is deliberating about what's in the general good, that has nothing to do with the power of money. That has to do with people trying to figure out as best they can what's in the public interest.
One of the things that seems to me to have driven this phenomenon, and I think it's a hugely important development, is, I hate to say, I don't want to be partisan, but the Republican Party seems to have have come to believe that the market is God. They don't seem to believe in the mixed economy, and they sell this to the population at large, which and the Democrats don't really do much to argue against. I mean, they do some. They say, well, we need health care, and they talk about the benefits. But there's never much of a general discussion about the place of markets in human life, except for everybody to bow to them. Well, what
except
do you think
in that book.
Right, they should all read my book. Well, this gets back to, as people get confused about the market system as a whole and thinking that the implication is that somehow if you accept the market system, you have to accept markets everywhere. And that just doesn't follow. There's a lot more complexity in, you know, what kinds of markets we want and where we want them. But if you believe in a democratic society, then you need to limit markets in some domains, because complete marketization is incompatible with democracy, with the institutions we need, both the minimum goods that people need in order not to be under the thumb of other people. If I'm desperately hungry or poor, I'm going to be under the thumb of other people. I might as well be in a feudal society as opposed to a democratic one. We have to think about democratic decision making. There are also some markets that have very harmful effects on people. Usually that's because people have weak information, and so they engage in trades with very bad consequences.
So
there's a whole array of considerations that we need to bring that are give us a different lens with which to think about markets than just thinking about them in terms of their efficiency.
So in some, there's no one principle. There's just a whole...
There's four principles.
There's a whole, yeah. So there you go. But you on know, that note, Deborah, I'm gonna thank you for joining us. It's been a terrific conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Deborah Satz. She's a professor of philosophy at Stanford University. She's author of the very, very fine book, Why Some Things Should Not Be For Sale, except the book is for sale, The Moral Limits of Markets.
And we want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
Yeah. So, John, well, what are you thinking now? What's your final thoughts on this topic? Oh, are you less in favor of markets or more in favor of markets?
Oh, I'm less in favor of markets than I pretended to be in the opening, but more in more in favor of markets than some people. My thinking is that, you know, this is an endlessly fascinating topic, and one angle we ought to pursue someday is the extent to which market thinking and evolutionary thinking, both of which have exerted a lot of political influence over the last century, are connected. I used to be a colleague with Friedrich von Hayek, who wrote The Road to Serfdom, which had a tremendous influence on the conservative movement in America. And he used to make the distinction between spontaneous organization, which was good, and central control, which was bad. And I think that's a very fundamental and interesting point that's exhibited by a lot of things in the natural world, as well as markets. And putting a limit on it requires deep thought.
I agree with you, but I do think... So, look, the planned economies, the commanding heights of the socialists, capitalism won out in that, or seems to have won out. I mean, the Chinese are still around, but seem to have won out. But with the idea that the command economy was not the right thing, came the idea, oh, capitalism, democratic capitalism. But I think something Deborah said is profound, and one of our questioners said is profound. It's not an all or nothing thing, right? I mean, the economy, I think one of the great inventions of the 20th century was the mixed economy. And, you know, markets, non-markets, all kinds of distribution. And I just don't think we think hard enough. Partly because we turned it over to the economists and the business people and the politicians who are in their thrall to do most of the public discoursing. So I'm so glad that Deborah wrote this book. And I hope philosophy gets to be a major player in this debate, which goes on, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program as well. Just go to our website and follow the directions. Now, for the final word, we test the moral speed limits of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, there are still people out there stumping for a free, unfettered marketplace. All such a thing as desirable is beyond me. I mean, isn't that what cocaine dealers have? No taxes, they can sell wherever, whenever, and to whomever they want, and the only thing standing in their way are easily corruptible law and order representatives. Oh, and the occasional firefight with rival drug dealers. It does irritate me that capitalism feels compelled to fill every silent place and every blank slate. I thought the ultimate in capitalist invention and or desperation was when commercial messages started showing up on the little stick used to separate groceries. Now, certainly, if something can be sold, it will be sold from children to body parts. I can understand that, if not approve. What I don't get is real estate. I recently came back to my rented house to find a notice on the door saying that the joint was going to be sold at a foreclosure auction in 2 weeks' time. According to the notice, my landlady owed $470,000 to a mortgage company. Looking up the property online, I learned that the house is worth only $230,000. I called a realtor acquaintance who did some further research and discovered that the mortgage in this house had been tranched, along with dozens or hundreds or thousands of other mortgages that had been sliced into pieces and put in a pool, with around 30 different entities having a piece of the pie. Well, they don't actually own the pie, just a piece of the pie's revenue stream. These mortgage-backed securities have a hierarchy. Senior shareholders get money first, and so on down the line until juniors get their cut. If the house is foreclosed, seniors will get money, but juniors won't because the money will be gone by the time it gets to them. So the juniors don't want the house foreclosed because they're still getting a revenue stream. From where? I don't know. I guess Fannie Mae and the like, certainly not from my landlady. Now, recently there's been a freeze on foreclosures as mistakes have come to light from lenders robo-signing documents, signing without reading, forging signatures, fake notary seals, and so forth. So now desperate homeowners, and I suppose junior shareholders, have given work to great squadrons of lawyers to halt the foreclosure process. And of course, those who want foreclosures to move forward have their legal platoons as well. This is called tranche warfare. My particular auction has been postponed for a month and a half. When I called the number of the mortgage company to find out what was going on, I got not them, but a law firm in Los Angeles. Yet another shareholder in the non-existent pie. Nobody's going to buy this house for $500,000 because it's worth only half that. If it is foreclosed because of all the tranches, no one person will actually hold the actual mortgage, and the property will not only be worthless, it won't be owned by anybody. So I'll probably be making my rent check out to something like Kuda and Shark as attorney-in-fact for the First Bank of Delaware, successor trustee to Megabank N.A., as trustee for Fully Formed Mortgage Investment Assets Fund Trust Series PSA CDO-0025AR8. Clearly, I'm going to have to get bigger checks. It's an economic apocalypse, and until I'm evicted, I'm thrilled to be a part of it. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Eric Blazeski and Joshua Raul Brody.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Angela Kilduff, Merle Kessler, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is the brilliant Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research, and the wise Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.